to the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rutschero, the chef in a hat.
And I'm Cleo.
We are owners of several of Seattle's fine restaurants. I have a batch here, right here at 4th and Virginia, including the Dahlia Lounge, Sirius Pie, and of course Lola, and this beautiful cooking school that we do our show from.
Right. The
look,
Hot
we have
Stove
a new
Society.
Sign up there. There we go.
Hey, look at that.
And wow. We have lots of guests. Terry?
I have Luc down in Madison Valley, which is a French-American bistro. With, by the way, we just opened the patio, so stop the rain, make the sunshine come in. And Lule downtown at corner of 6th and Union, bottom of the Sheraton. And that's it.
That's not just it, though, because you can get that delicious caviar egg there.
Every week we're joined by Katie O on the go.
That's right.
A graphic designer at heart, but also a creative person.
Just a creative soul, I would say.
When we worked together, I really liked that part about your capabilities. Was I could say, you know, I'm thinking about this little chicken bar, blah, blah, blah. Next thing I know, on my desk would be a graphic for the logo and for... layout, and I love that.
Who knew? Who knew that I had it deep down inside of me to be making menus? But it was super fun.
That's why I'm talking
about
it. Right,
that's true. you saw the talent.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Anyway, we have a large show for you today, 2 hours long. We hope that you hang with us the whole time. If you can't, you can always go podcast the parts that you miss and pick us up later. We're going to take your questions, of course, as we always do. Bridget Charters is going to join us here from the Hot Stove to talk about the junior camp that's happening in July for 10 to 15-year-olds here at the Hot Stove. We have our favorite tips on keeping your cast iron pans in tip-top shape, which is, I think, very important. Nothing's worse than walking over to your cast iron and having it just be a big pile of rust.
Yes, and have it not have its nonstick beautiful qualities, which is what you buy those for.
Or use it to put a nail in the wall.
Use it to do what?
Put a nail in the wall.
Put a nail in the wall.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's many usage to cast iron.
It was so far out there that I couldn't even, like, go back and figure that out.
Your accuracy to that nail... from the pan has to be very good, I would
say. I know.
Say.
I was thinking an L in the wall, like when you throw a pan at the wall and the handle creates kind of like an L.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't quite get the nail part. And, of course, we have our food for thought, tasty trivia at the end of the show, which is the audience has guaranteed me that I'm going to win today.
Oh, really? They made you that guarantee? They signed some sort of paper?
That's going to cost you a lot of money. You know that.
Well, I'm just saying. that's what they kind of nodded yes when I said I wished to win the trivia today, and they all kind of went like,
they're like,
sure you will. They didn't say, I just saw the head nod.
Got it.
Up next, though, we're going to go ordinary to extraordinary. Let's dazzle some people.
Let's dazzle some people with your extraordinary talents in the kitchen. These are some ordinary items or dishes, and then you're going to use all the knowledge you've gained throughout the years in those kitchens to make them extraordinary. The first one being, it's still artichoke season. I'm still seeing them beautiful and tight
yeah,
little bulbs.
Yeah, it's the beginning,
grocery store. So how do we take the... I wouldn't call it an ordinary artichoke because I find them quite extraordinary to begin with. But how do you make them extraordinary?
Well, I would disagree with Chef just a little bit. I don't consider it the beginning of the Castro Valley artichoke season. I think we have actually peaked and are on the downside of it. I could be wrong. I'd love somebody from Castro Valley to argue with me about that.
Mm-hmm.
I think of it being that kind of cool March, April kind of time. Now, when you get hot, they start to blossom, right? They're thistles by nature.
I still think it's in the heart of it, but whatever.
You're thinking
either
about
way,
artichoke hearts.
Right.
Okay.
Either way, we're still in the midst of it. We can still get them.
I would say I'll start I like the babies. I like to take the top off, trim around the outside so that all you're left with is a completely edible choke.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, the choke hasn't separated out into the little stringy choking bits.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take them and I whack them in thin little wedges, dredge them in, just put them in the acidulated water so they keep their color, dredge them in semolina right before I fry them in either olive oil or peanut oil and get a crispy artichoke. But you get the whole thing. With the big ones, I feel like you have to waste so much to get to that edible part.
You've really got to work at it.
And the baby ones take some work, too, and they're more expensive, but it's a more fulfilling, more gracious artichoke frit than throwing away all the leaves of the big ones and doing all that stuff.
So delicious.
So Jerry? I would take a big one, and I would take the leaves out and steam them on the side for dipping artichoke leaves. But I would take the bottom and slice them super thin on a mandolin, and not the musical instrument, but the actual slicer, and slice them super thin, and then saute them in blonde butter. So melt some butter, lots of butter in a pan, blonde stage, put all your artichoke, toss that around, a squeeze of lemon, some toasted pine nuts added to it at the end, and a little bit of chopped basil, and you've got a wonderful, wonderful artichoke stew.
My goodness, that sounds
and that's a great
very
garnish
delicious.
Too. You could add that to a salad, or you could do it as a garnish to a squab.
Really,
everybody should do a squab.
Everyone should do a squab. No one's intimidated
but
by
great,
squab.
It's great with chicken. It's great with cheese. You know, you can do all kinds of different things to it. So,
all right, let's hit a fairly common thing that you'll see pretty much everywhere in the world, as long as you're near a resort, is a Caesar salad.
Got to be careful right now. Make sure it's not from Arizona, apparently.
Yeah, that romaine. Everyone's issues. Very scared about yeah. that romaine. Yeah. You can make Caesar salads with all sorts of things, though. So I don't know if that
but
necessarily
usually it
makes
requires, to me, I think it means a crunchy lettuce, not a soft lettuce, you know, for a Caesar.
Yeah, because a bib lettuce salad is just a whole different animal.
Right.
So it does require a green leaf.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, so many people are using kale now instead of romaine or a combination.
Let's make it extraordinary, though.
Extraordinary?
Yeah.
Make it real. Use real anchovies. Pound them, you know, ground them really nicely. Egg yolks. Finish your dressing that way. If you make a real Caesar dressing like it's supposed to be made, I think it tastes really delicious. And then nice little crouton, fresh croutons, you know, in your salad. That's also very helpful. None of this made-up story of, you know, stuff made 6 months ahead. Just make it fresh, and if you make it fresh, it's a very delicious salad. I think that's what would make a Caesar salad extraordinary.
There's a couple of keys for me. I always start with a coddled egg, so just I drop it in boiling water just to clean up the egg, and then I use the raw egg as the basis of my dressing. Great Dijon mustard, not too much garlic. You don't want the garlic to overpower everything else that's going on in there, and I think that we have a mistake sometimes of if the sum is good, more is better. Reggiano Parmesan grated. The croutons must be sautéed in butter and olive oil and crispy, salty, and used warm and put into the salad before you dress it so they soak up that delicious dressing.
Yes.
It is like Caesar jumped out of the grave.
I'm convinced.
And then, of course, fresh, crispy lettuce I think is huge.
Anchovies?
And, I don't necessarily think we need a batch of anchovies on top. I think anchovies were intended to kind of be the umami flavor.
Right.
And again, because anchovy is good doesn't mean more anchovy is better. That's my personal take on that. So then that's going to leave us to tips and tricks.
That's
keeping your cast iron pans salty delicious on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Seattle Kitchen, you're back in it. We're at the Hot Stove Society with a very lively audience. And Katie, we're going to talk about some cast iron pans. And Chef, I imagine you grew up with pans like Le Creuset or Staub.
Absolutely.
Which is that enameled cast iron pan. And of course, in the States here, we all grew up with kind of the black cast iron.
Right,
you know,
what
most familiar now is the Lodge brand. Right. I think they're out of Tennessee or something like that. But tell us about the difference that you feel now that you've probably used both.
I use both,
yeah.
And I have some in my kitchen. I have a couple cast iron pan, 12-inch and 8-inch, and I love them very much. But I think the enamel has a little bit more purpose in terms of the surface of cooking. It gets as hot as a cast iron pan. The only difference is it doesn't stick the same way. You know, all you have to do is put a little fat on that enamel, and it's a beautiful pan that doesn't stick.
Right. What I love about the enamel, taking off on that, is you don't get any of the reaction with
iron
your
flavor.
Sauces, right? You don't get any of that kind of tinny flavor.
Yeah, that livery kind of flavor, that super iron flavor. You do get that very much from a cast iron pan, but I think there is a way to season your pan that also alleviates that, because most of that flavor is due to the inaction in the pan. I think if you have a cast iron pan, you don't use it every day, those fats and those thing that are into the cast iron do go rancid. And that's one of the flavor you pick up that goes between that and the iron itself that just gives you a flavor.
So your suggestion would be you have to use it more often so that you know they don't have a chance to.
Correct.
Really.
Correct. If you use it every day, if this was your main pan, you wouldn't have that issue, not even half as much. But because you let it sit for days and days on, you get all these flavors and you recuperate. So one of the advice is either take a little bit of salt, put it in your pan, burn the pan really, really high, and then re-season your pan before you use it.
Okay, so let's go back to that a little bit, because that's going to take the finish off your pan, right? That's going to take your existing seasoning.
It's going to take that rancid.
Which is something you tend to want to avoid.
Well, you want to tend to avoid. If you use it every day, you don't need to do that. But if you don't use it very often, mm-hmm. you're basically renewing the pan.
Right. So that's a mistake I think a lot of people make, and that is they think about like when they're blackening things. You see that was so popular in the 80s, right? Paul Prudhomme and the Louisiana blackening craze, and it's still popular. My golf club still has a blackened salmon Caesar on the on the menu. You know, it's still out there. And that cast iron pan really should be set aside for that purpose, because you're burning off your carefully created seasoning on the pan each time, and you're back to raw iron and next thing you know, you got rust.
Correct.
So I want to back up a little bit. Let's say you go to your pot rack, and now you've got, you're picking it out, and you see a little rusty circle in there because it didn't quite get dry when you did it. How do you get rid of the rust? For me, I take a, put it on the burner, I take a paper towel with some vegetable oil on it, and as it gets hot, I kind of wipe the pan, and as it gets a little hotter, I'll wipe the pan again. If it's really bad, I'll really put a lot of oil in it, and I'll throw it in the 500-degree oven for about an hour or two and just let that seasoning kind of work its way
just
into
a little
the pan.
Bit of oil, not too much.
Yeah, you don't need a pile of it. So so then now we've got our pan back and ready to go. You say cooking it every day. I say once you get that seasoning back, I think you can take it right over to the sink after you're done and wash it with soap and water.
Right.
Just not a Brillo pad or a scratchy, right?
Correct.
You don't want to take that seasoning off.
Mm-hmm.
Then I take it right back to the stove, and I heat it back up, and I don't put oil. You don't need to put oil back in that pan if it's maintained its original seasoning.
Yeah, you're just really trying to evaporate
dry
the water at that point,
the
so that when you store it, it doesn't end up rusting, and then you have to go through the process yet again.
Every time.
And
yeah.
the easiest way to clean a cast iron pan is to, when you're done cooking, just keep it on the fire, get it hot, put it on the very cold running water with a brush, and then brush it up, and then you'd be done.
Yeah.
Wow. You and I just have such different thoughts on this.
Well,
this is funny because I, too, probably have just a slightly different tweak from the both of you as well.
I'm going to go back to his 1 second.
Yeah.
To me, I have actually broken cast iron pans in half by putting a hot pan under cold water. Cracked them. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So I'm curious about that. Yeah. What's your thought, Katie?
I'm somewhere in between the two of you in terms of the technique on the care of the cast iron. And I think this is where a lot of probably our audience members get confused, because there's a lot of different techniques that are out there in terms of care. My understanding, or what I've always done with my cast irons, is when I first get it, even if it says it's seasoned, is to take that steel wool to it, really get it clean, and then season it yourself in the oven.
Oh.
Much like you're saying, Tom, with the 500-degree oven oiled, and actually what you want to do, or what I've done, is put a sheet pan underneath one of the racks, and then you invert it. So it's all oiled, you invert it, it's in there for about an hour, comes out, take a look at it, you can see if it's glossy or not, and you can repeat the process if you feel like it's maybe not well seasoned.
I think that's the perfect way to do it.
And
then,
why don't you take the original seasoning off? Technique that Lodge has been doing maybe for the last 10 or 15 years.
I guess I've found, and maybe this is incorrect, but like the cast iron pans that I'm getting aren't really all that well seasoned.
Hmm.
So that could be the brand that I'm getting. It could be, sometimes I get them as hand-me-downs. Like a lot of my cast iron, in fact, is actually from Goodwill or wherever, because that's where the cheapest, easiest.
That's where I bought mine 25 years ago.
Yeah, they've got some life to them. They last forever, so there's nothing wrong with them if you find them at a secondhand store. And then in terms of care, usually I really reserve my cast iron for things, either cornbread, like the other night, or searing a steak pretty heavily. And the technique I use for that is really sticking it into an oven cold oven, bringing everything up to 500 degrees, and then searing. At that point...
Sear your steak in the oven?
No. So because I have electric burners, they don't get very hot, nor do they stay very hot, because electric burners turn on, they turn off. That's kind of how they regulate the heat. And so if you stick your cast iron, I learned this from, I want to say, America's Test Kitchen a long time ago. If you stick it in the oven and it raises to 500, it's going to hold 500 much better than sticking it on the stovetop, letting it come to heat.
So I use that principle on putting it in the barbecue. If you light up your barbecue, mm-hmm. and when you first turn your barbecue on, you know, with the coals, you stick a cast iron pan in there and you close the lid, and you come back 25, 30 minutes later, that pan is hot, and you can do a nice searing, plus it's got a little smokiness to it, lightly, but... You know, it's a nice paint to seal.
Let's get to a couple other things on this list of how to handle your cast iron tools. You really do have to be careful not to scrape off the seasoning.
Right.
But it's hard to do that. And I wouldn't worry so much about using bamboo. That's more like a Teflon issue rather than a cast on issue, or cast iron issue. Protect your hands is one of the things. Those handles get hot, right?
Yeah.
It's not like a modern all-clad or something where the heat doesn't travel up the handle a bit. These handles are hot.
I've definitely accidentally touched the handle of my very hot cast iron before. I think a lot of people have.
I always wash my cast iron with soap, and it frankly, this article says never to do it. So you make your choice.
Well, if you do the technique of deglazing when it's really hot, you won't have any issue. But that's...
And this one says you should work out. Work out with some weight training before you attempt. I mean, there is the case that, depending on the size of you sometimes, that when you're reaching in that oven with a full cast iron pan with the roast or something, and it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, watch your low back.
Up next, we'll have an update on Pebble Mine and Betty. Our friends at SIP Northwest are having a shindig, and we'll tell you all about it on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society here in downtown Seattle. Chef, we have lots to talk about this time. We're going to talk to SIP Northwest Magazine folks, Aaron and Kristen, and also we're going to do a little update on Pebble Mine. You know, I'd asked our listeners to get online and email the EPA and plead with them to at least extend the comment period for the Pebble Mine with the Department, U.S. Corps of Engineers, I think is where it's at right now, because they had only given us 30 days to organize any sort of conversation about this, and they did. So they did. They extended it to 90 days, which is good, so you still have a chance to get online and go talk about, go find out more about Pebble Mine, the open pit copper and gold mine they're planning in the headwaters of the last great salmon run left on Earth in Bristol Bay, where last year we got 56 million sockeye to return through this well-managed fishery. That makes over 35 million fish a year for the last 4 years, 5 years in a row.
Right.
Record counts every year because it's managed by a great fishery. So remember to eat wild to save wild, because if you don't eat the salmon and create an economy around this fish, the locals are going to want to mine instead, because they have to feed their families.
Correct.
And they have to have jobs. And but we prefer, personally, very personal about this, because I also sell a lot of salmon.
Very personally, you and a million people.
We try to create this economy for tons and tons of people, but I prefer a wild fishery over a toxic gold and copper mine. Because it does take arsenic to get copper out of the ground and gold out of the ground, you know?
Correct.
It has to go somewhere.
And I think also, being in this part of the world, I am extremely chauvinist and proud of the wild king salmon, or the wild salmon in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that we have in this part of the world that we should cherish and make sure it doesn't go away.
Also, you and I today are having an event down at Food Lifeline after the show. And I'm excited about that. And I'm just a reminder out there that people are hungry year-round. They're not just hungry at Thanksgiving and Christmas. So when you think about your giving dollars and being part of your village, whether it's $5 or $500, think about it kind of on a monthly basis and support the operations of these fabulous providers of meals all around Western Washington.
And can you remind Tom and Terry, the audience and listeners, what Food Lifeline does?
Sure. Food Lifeline, we like to call this segment the Aunt Betty segment, because Aunt Betty gave us a surprise $1 million.
Woo! But
Aunt Betty was very generous.
She was very generous.
Food Lifeline is a food bank distributor. So unlike a food bank, say, in your neighborhood, Food Lifeline distributes to those food banks. They're a large warehouse. They rescue grocery products.
It's like the bank of food.
Yeah. So they have buying power like crazy. They have federal... food that they distribute throughout Western Washington, and they are just the most efficient charitable hunger relief organization.
Their efficiency is not a joke. They work at 92 cents to the dollar, which is pretty crazy. It's a very, very high number. Mm-hmm. And each dollar gives you four meals. So that money goes a long, long, long way.
All right. Up next here, we have Aaron and Kristen from SIP Northwest Magazine. And they're doing also an event. But I'm going to let you tell me about it, since I could really screw this up easily.
Sure.
Tell us all what's going on here.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, there's nothing better than drinking and eating for a good cause. So we're really excited. We're teaming up again with the Washington State Firefighters Council for another big charity event on May 17th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the new Sanctuary in Seattle. Which is, I don't know if you guys are familiar, it is a 100-year-old church, one of the oldest Byzantine churches in the country, that has been recently renovated to the tune of about $40 million.
Oh,
so no small it's, sum.
It is absolutely incredible. The architect, Philippe Stark, which hopefully you familiar with, came in and did all the interiors and everything. So this is really one of the first events of this kind that's going to be held at this beautiful, amazing venue.
So is that the old Plymouth Church down on 6th Avenue?
Yeah. Fifth and Madison, yeah. I think, right there. Yeah, and it's just been so beautifully restored. I mean, it's just like awe-inspiring. I mean, when you walk in, you see how grand this place is and what a great job they've done at really revitalizing the space.
So. How exciting that you get to have an event there. I've certainly driven past that spot quite a few times and have seen it from the exterior, and it looks gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, the event space is great. I mean, that's definitely what a lot of people are going to, you know, come to experience. But we're doing this for a cause. And so my cousin, Mark Jones, who was one of my original investors in the magazine, gave me a little bit of seed money to start the publication almost 10 years ago. He's a battalion chief in the fire department. And so it's been a cause that's been near and dear to our heart. We actually produce a cancer prevention guide for the Washington State Firefighters Council. And this event, all the proceeds are going to the Washington State Firefighters Council, the Benevolent Fund, which is basically the Washington Firefighters Council created this fund in January of 95, which is a nonprofit that provides assistance to firefighters, their families, people in need, and community organizations. So it's a really, really important charity, 501(c), especially coming into the fire season right now. So
benevolent being, are these the firefighters who died in the line of duty?
A family member or a firefighter or some connection to a firefighter, yes.
Right.
I am going to jump in here and say the name of our event.
Oh, yeah.
Is the SIP Experience, and the whole point of calling it that is that we are quite literally bringing the pages of the magazine of the spring issue to life at the sanctuary. So our main focus is to, while we love you reading our magazine, we are a regional publication dedicated to wine, beer, spirits, and cider in the Pacific Northwest. We want you to actually taste that too. So that's the entire premise, and what makes it a really one-of-a-kind event is that it's so unique that you're actually tasting what is on the pages. So we're really proud of that, and to be doing that in a venue like the Sanctuary and for a cause like the Firefighters Council is pretty incredible.
All right, so tell me, what is on the pages? What are they tasting? Because I know they don't want to eat paper products.
Right, yeah, so it's
and
really
is
cool.
Is it scratch and sniff?
You know, yes, basically. Well, so we have a story, a feature called Around the World in there, and we talk about absinthe, and I think absinthe is one of those things that people just don't understand. Like, how do they drink it? What do they drink it in? Like, you know, everything.
Most people think of people going crazy, drinking it,
right?
You know, chopping off an ear,
right? Exactly,
like that.
Hallucinating everything. So we're here, and we're going to have a table specifically about absinthe, a couple different ways to try it, how to louche it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, exactly. I didn't even know what that was.
Which is the drip fountain.
Yeah. Another thing is we're going to be setting up an ultimate mimosa bar. We're going to be partnering with Gruet, and then we're going to have really cool different variations of, you know, just your typical mimosas. We have a tequila bar featuring Papa Bueno, which is a local Seattle-based tequila company. The Halo bar upstairs is just absolutely amazing. I mean, there's literally a halo, I think, probably like 40 feet that like suspends over the bar. So they're going to be up there serving up some of their reposado and different tastes along with some specialty cocktails. And
We have a story on heritage cider apples and ciders made from that, and that's something that is going to be a little more of an educational area where people are going to be able to taste those ciders and see what makes them unique and why they have the tag heritage.
And what is heritage?
And yeah, what is exactly. Heritage? We had a whole feature on the bar essentials for your home bar. We're going to have a little home store set up showing all those products.
How long is this party?
It's 3 hours long. So
okay, yeah, I always that's a lot of education.
Totally,
that's cool.
Yeah. The cost, by the way, the cost.
You
is
don't have to go one by one.
Right.
No.
The cost is $45. So there's a lot of stuff that is included.
That's very inexpensive.
I know. We agree. That's why we're trying to get out there and spread the message, because we have about 8 different food partners. We've got Pincho and Claret Wine Bar, which is the new wine bar from Heavy Restaurant Group. Fico, several other really great restaurant producers.
And what day, can we remind everyone what day and what
May
time?
May 17th, and that's a Thursday. It's going to be 6 to 9 p.m.
I feel like it's so affordable. Everyone should just decide to...
It's a no-brainer.
Uber.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Pay
it's right downtown.
For Uber.
It's so working producers.
I have a quick question. Is it going to be a bunch of firemen going around with the boot?
We were just talking about that yesterday.
Yes. I love that boot. I never saw
there
that
will
in France.
Definitely, there will definitely be firefighters in attendance. We can say that for sure. So hopefully they do have the boot. We do, definitely want to raise some money for them. So
excellent.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations, because that's a very good community work you're doing there.
Thank you.
Very awesome.
Thank you.
So it's $45 online at
SipNorthwest.com/the Sip Experience.
Or $60 at the door. So it'll pay for your Uber to buy it online.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Instead of going all the way to the door. I can't wait, Terry. I would love to go to this, but I'm going to be in Scotland. So you need to go. Katie,
we'd love to have you guys.
We'll go for you.
We will go.
I will buy your ticket, Katie.
Oh, my goodness.
I'll buy you a cocktail.
Okay.
Well, the point is, I'd like to have a report back on this, because as we talk about on the show all the time, and just to wrap up this segment, it takes a village.
It really does, for God's sake.
And whether it's a giving food to your neighbors or working for people who have died in the line of service, the fire department, whatever it is, whatever it makes you tick.
Mm-hmm. And makes a better community.
The important part is being part of your community and being part of the village.
That's right. So, participate.
There you go. That's my little speech for the day. I'm sure everyone was happy to hear that. Up next, what do you do when you have a dinner party with browned butter in every course?
I'm definitely showing up.
I got to figure it out. I want to know.
You're the chef in charge, buddy, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Oh, we are back in the cuisine, cooking away. This is Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And Tom Douglas, and the chef who's unhatted.
That's right. Yeah. And I'm not a chef, nor do I have a hat on, but it is time for a dinner party, and this is where you two come over to my place and cook a whole meal using one particular ingredient. And normally we invite a special guest, but Terry, I think you are special enough, because
Am I the one?
Yes, it's very much tailored to you, the special ingredient, and that is brown butter.
Ooh. Yes.
I think we should invite Chef Pépin, don't you?
Yeah, we should invite Jacques Pépin or somebody like that. That would be like, bien sûr, brown butter, beurre noisette.
Yes, exactly. I can't have to wait for my skillet.
That's perfect. I love when you go through your contacts list and pick out the most famous chefs to bring over.
No, Jacques would be very excited to come to a dinner like that. He would love it.
Indeed. So, as we normally do, you're going to take this one ingredient and use it in every single course. You'll take turns dish to dish. So, who would like to do the appetizer and cocktail hour?
Cocktail, chef?
Sure, why not?
Little rum?
Little rum?
And brown butter?
Sure, why not? Hot buttered rum?
Yeah.
But it just seems like the wrong time of year for hot buttered rum. But I think a rum cocktail, a rum punch, with a little... I'm going to take macadamia nuts and I'm going to grind them up with a little nut flour and the macadamias and a little island honey. Mm. And we're going to make a little lacy... Tuil of some sort to go with our rum cocktail, our rum punch, because brown butter is a perfect Twill item, right? It That's actually perfect. Browns as it's cooking anyway.
Right.
And then if you start with it, it'll be even extra special, delicious. So the rum punch that I love is something with guava, you know, just some sort of tropical fruit.
Mm-hmm.
One part rum, one part juice, and then one part lime juice. So because you have to really balance out that sweetness a little bit with the sour of the lime.
Good.
So on a big ice cube, we have rum punch with a macadamia nut twill brown, with brown butter.
I
and
like
Jacques Pepin right now.
He's going to love his cocktail.
He's thinking he made a good decision.
I think so, too. What a nice thing to start out with something a little bit sweet. You don't often have that, but, you know, it's dessert first sometimes.
Well, rum punch is a little bit sweet, too. I think it works fine.
I think so,
too. And I think Jacques is obviously very French, so it's very traditional to start dinner with the soup. So I'm going to start with an artichoke soup. We finish with brown butter.
Mm-hmm.
So you pureed all, you cooked all your artichoke hearts. You cook everything together, nice little amount of butter, lots of sliced onion in there, so onions and artichoke.
Mm-hmm.
Finish with hazelnut, blend the whole thing up with a little bit of chicken stock, and then you take brown butter and you blend, when your butter is brown, you pour it into your blender and finish the soup with that. And it gives that really rich nuttiness and really silkiness of butter in there. It's going to be really disgustingly good.
Disgustingly good, he says.
No, I mean, I think a good artichoke soup would be a good evening.
Well, the last artichoke soup I had was in Paris.
Oh, at Guy Savoy.
Guy Savoy. And Guy Savoy or Guy Savoy?
Guy Savoy.
Guy Savoy. And this was, what, 15 years ago maybe, 20 years ago? It was $100 a bowl.
What?
$100
He did not mention it was full of truffles.
Here's what I'll say about that soup. The most overrated soup in history. Everyone said, you have to have Guy's artichoke soup and truffles. And it's like, oh, my God. What a waste of $100.
Well, I didn't put... This one's not going to be $100 because we didn't put any truffles in it.
Well, at least if you're going to use truffles, use something that have flavor.
Yeah.
That would be nice.
Sick burn from
Tom Douglas. Well, sometimes, you know, Chef, it's true that people use the word truffle just for the word.
Right.
And not necessarily when they're at their peak.
I'm with you 100%.
It's pretty constant. Constantly a problem.
I can
not
see that.
Not that I'm bitter or anything.
I was going to say, I can see 15 years later, this is a chapping your idol.
He has not forgotten.
No kidding. All right, Tom.
People say my whole 9-inch coconut cream pie is overrated expensive at $39 for a whole darn pie.
But you know what you can't do? Finish that whole pie by yourself, I bet.
No, nor would I put truffles on it.
Yeah, you got to share it.
That would be gross.
It's a lot of value in that pie. All right, Tom, what are we going to have for our entree for Jacques?
With artichokes, huh? Well, you know, when I first moved to Seattle, the big thing was the steamed artichoke stuff with kind of buttered bread crumbs, and that would be great, but I don't know that's entree worthy unless we do something with a big pile of shrimp. And I
no, no, it's brown butter. Brown butter.
No, I understand, but a brown butter, the breadcrumbs on top would be interesting. But, I was thinking I had to go back to artichokes, but I don't, which is beautiful. So I'm going to do my favorite thing that I, you know, 28 years ago, I was meeting Terry for the first time in his kitchen at. I kind of came over maybe right before service or during service or something and went back into the kitchen disrespectfully, in his opinion, because I was in shorts and a T-shirt in his fancy restaurant. And
that seems like something you would do. I actually can picture the outfit in my mind.
Yeah.
And that's something I would say.
Might it be the same thing that I was wearing yesterday today? Or
25 years ago, I look at him like, what?
Some things don't change.
Have some respect.
You're dressed like a guy going to the beach. What are you doing in the kitchen?
Yeah. So anyway, so I don't remember if it's exactly them, but I certainly have picked it up over the years, the sautéing in brown butter. And my favorite thing to do that with is I love lamb chops. And the brun noisette, to get that rolling on your stove and then popping a double-cut lamb chop. The only reason I say double-cut is because the little popsicle lamb chops, the single cuts, often get overcooked
right
before you can get a nice sear on
Absolutely.
The outside. So I like a double cut chop that I can get a good hearty sear on. Even if you have to finish them in the oven, that's sometimes a good way to make sure you get that pink all the way through. Let them rest, and they are delicious. And I'll serve those with some Another thing my mother always made was roasted cauliflower with, or steamed cauliflower with brown butter on top of it. So now we've got it there, we've got it there, and then, of course, we'll have to have some brown butter mashed potatoes to go along with it.
And then we're all going to have a heart attack after Thierry's
dessert. Wait, 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 we haven't done this yet.
I know, I'm like...
And Jacques Pepin right now is ready to vomit.
Yeah.
So first strawberry of the year coming up, and we're going to make a nice little financier, because noblesse oblige. So financier is a traditional cake that is made with more butter than anything else in it. And brown butter is a perfect ingredient because it creates, again, that rich nuttiness that you don't get from just putting regular butter. So you just make the financier cake, which is egg yolk. I mean, it's eggs, sugar, flour, and butter. And once it's baked, you just take strawberry and you macerate them with a little bit of sugar and a little bit of basil and put the whole thing after a couple of hours. It's been sitting on the counter and you've been tossing it around. It's going to render a little bit of juice. Put that on top of the cake, and just because we can, a little whipped cream, vanilla whipped cream on the side. I think he's going to be like, oh, merci beaucoup, that was fantastic.
I think he's going to sing My Funny Valentine.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He did, remember?
He did. I do remember.
That was pretty precious.
Yes. A quick story about Jacques. I had him as a guest at the ballroom one time, and we had 300 people in the room, mostly women, and Jacques was a little bit tipsy. We got up on stage and started singing My Funny Valentine in French. And there were people bawling everywhere.
Swooning, bawling.
Unbelievable.
What an introduction.
Up next, we're going to talk about our Taste of the Week right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show.
Yay.
Hour number two. We have lots to go here in this hour. We're going to talk to Chef Bridget about the junior summer camp, ages 10 to 15-year-old, here at the Hot Stove come July. We're going to talk food for thought, tasty trivia. We have our questions that are lined up here.
That's right, from all of our listeners.
Very good show. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
Let's talk Taste of the Week.
Yes.
Did you have something delicious last week?
Oh, my gosh. I think probably we three are very good at always eating something at least delicious once or twice a week, if not more. But, yeah, definitely. There's a new little place that opened up in my neighborhood in the Central District called Reckless Noodle. And that spot has definitely had some things come and go. So I think the neighborhood is like, oh, gosh, what's going to be there next? But really, it's a delicious little noodle house. They've got a lot of different things, but it's very Southeast Asian focused. And the dish that I enjoyed the most is they had a curry vermicelli noodle dish. It's a little bit soupy vermicelli noodles, but chock full of like very delicious eggplant and vegetables and a good amount of spice. Coconut, and then you can kind of choose which protein you're interested in. But what I think they do especially nice there is beef cheeks. So it's a braised beef cheek in this coconut curry, some noodles, a lot of heat, cilantro, all that good stuff. So that was my taste of the week for sure.
What about you, Tom?
I would say, you know, I think sometimes the simplest tastes get overlooked. And I know that, personally, I don't eat a whole lot of Mexican food other than at my own restaurant, Cantina Leña. I love the tortillas there. I like the way we do our cheese, blah, blah, blah. But up in my neighborhood, there's a place called Luisa's. It's right on Holman Road. And I was reminded there last night. I was just getting a little pork chile verde, like a green pork, blah, blah, blah. And I walked in to pick up my order. And I love the little tortilla stand there. There's a nice woman just standing there chatting, patting out tortillas and griddling them. But the best part is while you're waiting for order, they just keep feeding you the hot tortillas that are slathered with butter, which you just don't see very often,
wow.
Right? And salt, and then a little bit of their tasty little salsa that they make.
This is better than, like, Krispy Kremes, because sometimes they'll give you a hot donut in the Krispy Kreme line, but I'd rather have this tortilla with butter.
I know. You just sit there, and you're almost full.
You're full by the time you leave.
I don't want to get carried away. I think the tortillas are very classic. You know, I don't know if you can be very classic or just classic. But, you know, they're just masa harina tortillas. There's nothing fancy. Like, we make super fancy ones at Cantina Leña, right? Mm-hmm. We do a lot of different things. But these are just delicious little fresh Mexican tortillas butter and salt and a little tiniest bit of salsa. And you really get the hot corn flavor. And I just love that little snack while you're waiting for your order to go.
I think that this is also a great tip for folks because I feel like everyone wants a better tortilla. And maybe not everyone is going to go through the trouble of making their own. So to have a resource up there on Holman Road, just go to Luisa's, get some tortillas.
Or I often buy them by the dozen there. And I often, with the leftover ones in the morning, I'll pan fry them in butter with salt and just get that kind of crispy
egg. In the morning, for breakfast? Goodness.
For breakfast. Oh,
delicious.
That and a cup of coffee? Yum.
Terry, what was your taste of the week?
My taste of the week was a dinner I quickly made at home with my son, Adrian. Kathy was out. I don't know what happened that night.
Partying without you.
Probably partying. And it was a leftover of tomato sauce that was in the fridge. And my son was like, oh, let's go eat out. And I'm like, no, we got to cook from the fridge. I'm like, we're going to play that little game of like, you know, 30-minute dinner. He's like, you can't make dinner in 30 minutes. I was like, okay, time on. Go ahead, 30 minutes. Put a big pot of water on the fire right away and, you know, make it to boil. And I made some egg noodle pasta. So I remade, I obviously redid the whole sauce. I had some button mushroom. I had some nice shallots. So I sliced the shallot, put it in brown butter, add the mushroom to it, sweated the whole, sauteed the whole thing together, added some fresh canned tomato, crushed into there, added the leftover of the tomato I had, and I had some in the freezer. I had a little bag of ground elk that somebody had given me. So I took that ground elk meat, and then throw it into the pasta, into the tomato sauce, made a wonderful little, beautiful elk meat tomato sauce, and then pour that, cook the egg noodle, kept a little bit of the juice, added that to the whole sauce. It was delicious, shaved Asiago on top. And my son was like, it was, by the way, 23 and a half minutes.
No big deal.
Like to make notions of that. That's how long it takes to make dinner, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't take that long. You just have to have a quick plan.
I find it hilarious that your son, Adrian, would even challenge you to make something in less than 30 minutes.
Well, because
given
he was trying
profession.
To go out. You know, he wanted to go out because they like to go out. You know, he's a restaurant guy, so he was raised in the restaurant. Going out to restaurant to him is like much easier than opening the fridge and cook.
Yeah.
So, lucky little guy.
Yeah, very lucky.
But I was like, nope, we're not playing that game tonight. So I'm like, we're going to finish what's in the fridge. And I thought that was a very quick, easy win. And all he had to do was garlic toast. I mean, olive oil toast, sorry. He made some olive oil and he had to toast them. So he kept waiting. He's like, so how much longer? I'm like, 8 minutes. He's like, you're not 8 minutes. I'm like, I'm 8 minutes. And he was like, no. And he was late on his toast.
His garlic toast was late?
It took me 23 and a half minutes to do the noodles. And it took him, he was late on giving me the toast. I was like, where are the toasts? He's like, it's coming, but, you know, it's taking longer than I thought. I'm like,
He thought you were going to take longer. He was estimating.
What would really be funny is if you distracted him and you kept talking to him and then the toast,
burned the toast.
Burnt under the broiler. That would be hilarious.
Anyway.
So tell me about the elk, chef. How long had it been in your freezer?
About 5 months.
Yeah.
Because I actually looked at the date. Because I date my stuff. It's one thing I do. I don't. There's a lot of things I don't necessarily do correctly at home, but we do date everything I put in the freezer. I date it because I don't like to be a museum. I like to have just a freezer.
So at what point would you have said, this thing is a little out of date for me?
Well, especially because it was
five months is a pretty long time.
Yeah, and
for
it was a thin
meat.
Package, you know, but this big that somebody had given me homemade. Ground elk, and I was like, man, I gotta eat this. But you know, it was never enough to make dinner, but that was perfect because it was just the two of us. And I remember it was downstairs because I just saw it.
So, back to my question, at what date would that? At what date?
I'm avoiding
the
question.
You looked at that and said,
I would say if it was more than a year old, I would give it away. I would not eat it. But, I can hide it pretty good.
Under socks.
I can disguise it pretty good.
My mother is well known for her vintage freezer items. I try to clean out the freezer once a year when I go back there, but I always keep things from each decade.
Right.
So.
Just in case.
60s, 70s, 80s, all represented. Because we don't want to lose the historical nature of it all.
If you're going to make a museum out of your freezer, you should charge for visits.
Yeah, exactly. It's time for questions from you, our faithful listeners. Nancy and Darcy and Allison and Chris and Elizabeth. It's going to be super fun if you hang with us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O. And it is time for questions from our listeners. This is where we go to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen, and see if you have any culinary quandaries. But sometimes we ask our audience if they have any questions for the chefs. And so one of our audience members, Lauren, has joined us on the mic very bravely. Lauren, welcome to our show.
Hi, thank you.
So are you an avid cook?
I am trying to be.
That's great. We like that.
I recently moved into my own apartment, so I am working on learning different techniques and how to chop things and expanding beyond the microwave, which has been pretty successful.
One quick way to do this is to just unplug it and put it outside.
How dare you? How dare you? The microwave has its place,
sir. No, but
sir.
She's training, so that's how you train. Yeah.
That's
put it on the back porch for a minute, or give it to your neighbor, say, did you use that for a week? And then see what happened.
Well,
see,
Lauren,
what you're actually missing.
This is a great place for you to be if you're trying to pick up some new skills. So what is the question that you have for this very professional panel today?
So I wanted to ask what, since we were talking about elk earlier, what your favorite meat is to cook with, what you think has the most flavor. It can be wild game or otherwise. I'm in the meat business, so I'm just curious to hear.
You're in the meat business.
Do you meet a lot of people?
Yeah. That means she runs a singles. She runs a singles bar.
The meat market.
Yeah.
I see. I see what you did there.
Oh, we both are very funny, aren't we?
You guys should take this on the road, this comedian duo. Okay.
All right, you can't just stop there. What do you do?
Oh, I'm working for a startup in Seattle, actually. It's called Crowd Cow.
Oh, okay.
So it's
You work
really
at Crowd Cow?
I do,
yes. I didn't even know that. That's
Terry loves Crowd Cow.
Yes.
All right, we're going to answer your question.
Yeah.
What's your favorite meat, Chef?
My favorite meat is the one that's in season, or that'd be the closest to the freshest. So, you know,
like
what,
5-month-old elk?
That was exactly my point. I was trying to get to that. You know, putting things in the freezer is great, but not forgetting it is actually more important, because the quality of the meat obviously deteriorates if you keep it in the freezer for over 6 months.
There we
so,
go.
My favorite, I probably would go with lamb. I'm a big lamb. I love lamb because lamb in general has a little bit more flavor than a lot of the meat. And, you know, sadly enough, unless you buy really good meat, like, you know, you guys sell at Crowd Cow, that's definitely good meat. But on the market, there's a lot of meat that tastes very similar or very bland, as far as I'm concerned. You know, and growing up on the, when I grew up on the farm. Everything we ate had a lot of flavor. You know, there was even the chicken were very flavorful. They didn't have that bland kind of text or nature of flavor. So,
of corporate farming.
Yeah, and lamb is where I'm going to go with.
I'm going to go with duck. I love duck.
I love duck.
I like
too.
It in all sorts of ways. But my favorite is sitting on my front porch with a little whiskey, watching it dripping and turning over a charcoal fire, over a pan of potatoes, dripping its fat, and generously lending us its unctuous flavor. That's my idea of a good day.
Yeah, that was visceral. That was...
Yeah. You really took us somewhere.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Skin gets crispy. The potatoes get creamy in the center and crispy on the outside, a little smokiness. And it is just my idea of a good time.
Delicious. Lauren, what
if
is...
If you want to go on a date with me, it has to be with duck.
There you go.
My wife knows this in a big way.
Lauren, what's your favorite meat as you experiment?
Well, personally, I've been... learning, you know, how to cook meat correctly, and I realize now that I do need a meat thermometer.
Mm-hmm.
It's essential.
Mm-hmm.
But I have been very successful in cooking chicken thighs, just, you know, trying different recipes, but the classic olive oil, rosemary, garlic, put in a pan with other root vegetables, and it's really, really good, especially.
Lovely.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
Very satisfying. Mm.
Fills my apartment with smell.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that.
You own it at that point.
Yeah.
Your curtains own it. Your pillow owns it.
And then you bring out that bottle of Febreze and air it all out.
Thank you, Lauren, so much for your question.
Thank
you, Lauren.
All right. Now we're going to go to our Facebook page. This comes from Brad. Brad, I think, might be putting his wife on blast, as they say. But I'll let you be the judge. He says, my wife and I are at opposite ends of the spectrum on this issue. When trying a new recipe, I prefer to follow the recipe very closely, then modify it based on personal preference or on-hand ingredients for subsequent attempts. She thinks the sign of a good cook is the ability to modify recipes from the get-go. Her approach has resulted in an occasional unpalatable meal, and we end up not being sure if it's the recipe or the modifications that are bad. My approach results in a higher grocery bill because I refuse to substitute plain old paprika for smoked Hungarian paprika. How do you approach a new recipe? I think there's an argument going on in this household that
Definitely. Is
kind of hinging upon your answer.
You know what sounds great?
Choose your side wisely.
It sounds like they both like to cook and they both are creative about it. They have two different approaches. I personally think that the first time you make a recipe you've never made before, you should read the recipe thoroughly and follow the recipe thoroughly, because that's what the recipe is made for. And also, you don't know what the end product is exactly going to be like. So you need to follow the recipe that the chef has made. Hopefully, they've made a good recipe and it will turn out exactly like they predicted. Tom?
I'm kind of in the same camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's something hot about a woman that just goes for it like that.
That's true. I don't want to squash her joie de vivre.
Know.
You know what I mean? Like, she's got some
chutzpah. I think that's sexy in the kitchen. Like, I'm doing it my way.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. I kind of like that, too. And so what? You know, you eat a lot of meals in your lifetime.
Exactly.
And who cares if one gets messed up? Let her be. I'm gonna defend his wife here for a second and say, you know what? She's doing you a solid. She's trying to make dinner. Let her make it how she wants to make it. And when you make dinner, you make it how you want to make it.
And Chef Terry is absolutely correct, but I'm just saying it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think
it is definitely cool, and she's adventurous to the point of changing things.
I wouldn't change her.
No.
Okay, we only have time for another one.
Okay, one last question. Allison Francis, what's your best macaroon recipe, and how do you get the shells with no hollows? I think this is a Thierry Rotrou question, unless you're making cute
macaroons. Well, I can give you the recipe. One minute. You need to do a beautiful meringue to start with, beautiful egg white, little baking soda, little sugar. Obviously, the whole thing needs to be beautiful, and it needs to be stiff. And then you pipe it onto your baking sheet, and you do not tap it. Because if you tap it, you're going to just drown the egg white. Mm-hmm. But you need to make sure that it's not full of bubbles. So when you pipe your macaron, when you finish with your pastry bag, you just gently go, oop. I mean, I can't describe that on the radio. You need to do a little twist of the wrist. So then you have that little, just a little bit of a tip to the macaron. And that should be, your macaron should be absolutely beautiful and fantastic.
Are you talking about the French macarons, like at Lodre?
Yeah.
They don't have tips on them.
No. But when you, that's what I'm saying, you do a twist of the thing, and it's going to be a little bit of a tip on top, and then it's going to settle in.
Oh, it settles when you bake it.
Correct.
Okay.
It's going to settle right in, and it's going to be flawless.
You make a filling out of the same thing?
You make a filling of whatever, well, the same thing, no, because
if it's a blueberry macaroon, say.
Right. If you do a blueberry macaroon, you do blueberry pastry
filling.
Cream.
Yeah.
And then you put it in there.
Okay.
But you could also have vanilla macaron and do all kind of filling with it, because vanilla macaron are just basically, or almond macaron are basically suitable to a lot of marriage. So, but a good macaron is a little practice, is what I would say to this young lady.
That's probably going to take you more than one go around.
It will definitely take a little bit of go around.
That's all right. Practice makes perfect.
Make sure you get your egg white stiff properly. That's the most important part.
All right, up next, Chef Rich is going to be here. We're going to talk about our junior camp happening in July right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Everyone's about ready to get there. Dahlia Bakery breakfast sandwich, which of course is something quite delicious I look forward to every Tuesday morning here at the radio show. Right across the street, you know, we have our little tiny, tiny, mini bakery.
That's right.
And they just love when we send over an order for 30 sandwiches.
That's what I've heard. Yeah. It's their favorite
They think
of
we
Tuesdays.
Are so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. They love you.
I would love to hear the real truth behind that one.
Well, what's impressive, I think, is that the buns come over a little crispy like they're supposed to. Hot. And delicious.
Yeah.
And we only have one little 24-inch griddle over there. So.
That's amazing. Maybe they need an extra griddle. Maybe
this is the present we should get them is another griddle. Yeah.
When we started those breakfast sandwiches there a few years ago, we would do 5 a day maybe.
Right.
Maybe. Now we do 150 to 200.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
They are really delicious.
That voice, I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
I'm Katie O.
And we are now joined by Bridget Charters, chef here at the Hot Stove Society and Glutton for Punishment.
Totally.
Not only are we going to talk about dealing with youngsters in summer camp, because you have one the same age, right?
Yes.
And then you're going to stay for the next segment where Terry and I are going to
play a trivia question, Tom. Don't sell it.
Food for thought, tasty trivia.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see, won't we, Tom?
I guess we will.
Remember when Bridget was scared to come on the show?
Yeah, not anymore.
I was going to say,
I miss not being on the show, Tom. Yeah. I'd even do it for free.
Ooh. Are you getting paid for this?
No. Live from New York.
Tom's looking around.
Wow. This is all news to me. Okay. Anyway, let's jump into summer camp.
Sure.
The number one request we get here at the Hot Stove is for kids programming.
Get out.
Yeah. Oftentimes.
I've been here four years.
I should say, of things that we don't do typically. We get asked a lot for kids programming, for summer camps.
And so I'm always recommending to folks to bring your kids to classes.
Mm-hmm.
Pasta 101, the knife skills. We had a teenager here last night at Knife Skills.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're doing artichokes tomorrow night. Absolutely. I think kids should come. You know, the French start teaching their kids young. Why don't we do this in America?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So, and kids are allowed to come to any Hot Stove class, except unless you'll see on it, if it's an over 21 class, you'll see, like, cooking, cussing, and drinking.
Right.
That's an over 21 class.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons.
For obvious reasons, yeah. Some of the bad words that are used
periodically. So how old are those kids who come to the camp, the summer camp you're planning?
A couple of years ago, we did it in the summer because there are programs here in the Seattle area that are massive, you know. But when you sign up for camps, you've got to be on, you got to jump on it, and it has to happen in February and March. Like, I get Spencer signed up for sailing camp, and like, you got to be there at the computer, like, ready to press the button.
It's like a reservation at the French Laundry.
Exactly. Same thing. So, anyway, with kids camps, I mean, I think once we get going with it and get the word out, I think it's great. And I think we need to teach our kids how to cook because it's just not happening.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing
the Omek class.
They make it. There are no demos. We're going to talk them through it, show them a little bit here and there, but it's going to be around tables and, okay, guys, this is how you do it. Now watch. Okay, now you do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, cool.
You know, just like culinary school, nice. I think. It's just, you know, little demos here and there,
hands
but
on.
It's hands-on, and they have to do it. We're not going to do it for them. We're not going to have stuff pre-prepped. They get it from raw ingredient and take it. And
Excellent.
Yeah, they'll learn dumplings. Hopefully, you know, maybe I'll have Shaoxing stop by or maybe get her to sign her kids up. We'll have to.
You know, I'm a pretty good dumpling maker.
Oh, we could get Tom to come
but
by.
But kids
would you come
and
by?
I'm not sure we get along.
Tom is the guy who glues the eggs
you right now.
He has one. He's like
Thank
me.
You, Katie, for telling people I'm teasing. I was a joke.
He's teasing. He'd be happy to come and make dumplings with all the kiddos.
You
did it with Loretta, I'm sure, yes?
Oh, I did. We made lots of dumplings in our lifetime.
That's
so, the recommendation is 11 to 15.
Mm-hmm.
16 is fine. Anything younger than that, they have a tough time focusing, and it's a lot of material.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going to teach them how to make bread. We're going to teach them how to make pasta. We're going to teach them how to build a good salad that they like.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's a kid salad that they like? Is that like a Thai beef salad or
yeah?
What's a kid salad?
Like the crunchy cobs, you know,
oh, okay.
With the crunchy lettuce
mm-hmm.
and the yummy things in there, you know, just what they like. And mm-hmm. but then too, for those older kids, and so we're going to be sensitive to the fact that there might be older kids, so we're going to give them, you know, work on them a little bit more. You know, when they go off to college, they should be able to cook.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, did you, you know?
Well, I got Loretta a toaster oven for under her bed at her dorm. And
is she famous, popular?
She did use it, but mostly for toast and for late night sliced pizzas that were a dollar at the local pizzeria. Yeah.
I bet she was super popular.
But what we did do was every twice a year, because I was on in the parents club or parents committee, whatever, we would go back and do our board meeting. And, you know, she was 10 hours from here by plane in south of Syracuse.
That's right. In Colgate, right?
Yeah, Colgate.
Yeah.
And so I would do a dinner for all her roomie friends and stuff. We would cook a dinner together, invite all the football team, because she was dating a kind of football team, and blah, blah, blah. And we had a blast. It was good fun.
I mean, it's awesome. You know, I remember being called up in college, hey, Bridget, okay, we'll get Bridget to cook, you know. And they'd go buy chickens, and we'd cook a meal, you know, because you can only have so much institutional food.
Right. I would say, I don't know how your kids were about this, Terry, but I would say from the perspective of, I'm watching this nice lady over here eating that sandwich over her lap, and they're drippy. I'm just letting you know they're drippy. I would say that it's super cool to know how to cook. You'll find your friends will think it's really awesome.
Yep.
When you know how to cook.
It doesn't look cool when your dad is doing it necessarily, but yeah. But it's a very cool, I mean, it's true. All your friends will really appreciate that you can cook.
Well, it's so nice that it looks okay. I remember when I told my mom I was going to culinary school, she was like, oh, you're going to be a servant? You know, and I was like, oh, Mom, come on.
Come on,
you know,
Mom.
You should have said, no, I'm going to be a doctor, but I'm going to culinary school.
You know, but it was amazing because now it's a big deal. But still, it kind of breaks my heart when folks come in here and they just go, I don't know how to cook. And
I was going to say, though, these kids are going to be so beyond where a lot of adults are, frankly.
Yeah.
You're talking about making breads and pastas. That is not something that the average adult is even interested or willing to tackle. But, like, what an amazing skill to be young and so mature in the kitchen.
And you're going to teach them how to make breakfast, which I think that's where every kid should start, because they love to make breakfast. Kids love to make breakfast. They get up late.
Yeah.
They have time. They make breakfast at 11 a.m., you know, but it's nice if they have little skills of like caramelizing some onions and
cheesy eggs, scramble.
Yeah. And then some bacon, and then throw in some eggs and make a nice little omelette or scrambled egg. Or, you know, I mean, that's nice that they know how to do that.
And
those
just,
are basics.
Yeah, and we're going to have stuff listed, you know, because then it's like, come on, guys.
And you
it.
Can always make breakfast for dinner.
That's true. Absolutely, yeah. So
I saw Friday would have been my day if at this age, 11 to 15. Friday would have been my day on your curriculum, which is sushi. Because so many children have grown up with sushi now in their lives, whether it's raw or like Ebby, the cooked shrimp, or vegetable sushi. Mm-hmm. Just the process of being able to put anything in a rice roll, I think would be really fun and easy to teach.
Yeah. Well, like you said, because you used to make fun lunches for Loretta, right?
Oh, yeah. My favorite lunch for her, and her, ended up being her favorite lunch, was I'd brown pot stickers in the morning and then put them in her thermos.
That's
and send
awesome.
A little black bean chili sauce on the side, and she would just pop them out, and her friends would gather around like she was the weirdest kid at the circus, you know. It's like
she's Harry Potter.
And then she would share a bite or two, and it's like, boom, everyone wanted her pot stickers. They wanted to trade her all this bologna for pot
right.
stickers.
Spencer's done with sandwiches, so mm-hmm. I do hand rolls.
Uh-huh.
I do, you know, but we do, I cook up chicken nuggets.
Ah.
Really?
Warm them in the oven and then cut them in half and then do the teriyaki sauce, your teriyaki sauce
uh-huh.
across them,
uh-huh.
and then roll that in the nori with
That'll
the rice.
That'll get them ready for college, because college kids love fried chicken fingers.
Yeah.
Adults love fried
chicken
fingers.
Let's get the dates and time here for this real quick before we finish.
So this is going to be July 9th to the 13th. So it's right after the 4th. It's one of those first summer camp weeks. It's less than some of the tech camps that are happening at UW. It's $7.50. And they're going to come in at 9 in the morning. We'll have a little breakfast here for them. And they're going to make their own lunch. But we're going to do something in the morning, something in the afternoon. So, for example, we'll have bread in the morning, and then that'll proof. They'll bake it while they're doing another technique in the afternoon. They're going to go home with pans of rolls and fresh loaves of bread and boxes full of pasta. I mean, they'll have dinner for you guys, you know, or components for dinner when they finish at 3 o'clock each day, and it's for the whole week.
So that's 5 days, 8 to 4?
Well, if they're here by 8:30, great. We start at 9,
okay,
and then they're done at 3.
Done at 3, okay.
And they can hang out. We can put on, you know, some kind of show out there in the loft bar, and they can hang out and wait for the parents.
Watch Julia Child.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, it'll be great.
All right.
Check it out, hotstovesociety.com.
Perfect.
All right.
We're going to jump right into Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge next here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. That was a delicious breakfast sandwich, I got to say.
I like that little
Tom, Terry, and KDO here at the Hot Stove Society in the Seattle kitchen. Our audience has finally sated a bit. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, and Chef Charters has gracefully decided to join us.
Thanks, Tom.
Even though we have threatened her abilities to win.
Mm-hmm.
Very
you
rude.
Have.
Oh, I have.
Yes, you have.
Right. Not particularly hospitable to the guests, but this is time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. Each of you are going to get 5 questions, and whoever loses, whoever gets the least amount of questions correct, has to give something to one of our audience members. And today it's Lauren, because she was so brave to come up to the microphone and ask her question about what meat it is that we like to cook the most. So, if you should lose, Tom, what are you going to give to Lauren?
What am I going to give to her? I'm going to give Lauren dinner for two at Carlisle Room, because we have a beautiful new giant rainbow platter smorgasbord of vegetables. And since she has to work with beef all day long, I am going to give her a rainbow platter of veggies at the Carlisle Room.
Terry Retro, what will you give to Lauren?
I think I'm going to come to brunch at Luke with someone. How about that?
With
Saturday
someone.
Or Sunday, and if it's a nice sunny morning, you'll be sitting on the patio, so here we go.
And I should say, mine's with someone, too, unless she wants to spend the whole $100 gift card on herself.
I mean, sometimes you want to take yourself out on a special date.
That would
so
be special.
You just never know. Bridget?
2 tickets to breads, delicious breads, with myself and Janet, and that is on May 29th. It's going to be a great
that
class.
That sounds like fun.
And
you
it's
guys are
all
so fun.
Hands-on.
Terry, you're going to go first. Here are your 5 questions.
All right.
The first one is, in preparing mushrooms for cooking, one should, is it A, wash under running water or brush lightly just before cooking, B, blanch and drain, C, use a salad spinner, D, never wash them because they absorb liquids?
I would say brush them.
That is correct. A, so either wash under running water and or brush lightly just before cooking. Very nice. Terry, your second question. What's the main problem with nonstick wok? With a nonstick wok, is it that the vapors from the nonstick coating kills pet birds? Is it B, can't heat it to proper temp for true stir frying?
This is the one.
Okay, that is correct. B is correct. Can't heat it to a proper temp for true stir frying. Although A is true, it's not the main problem. So actually, there you go. It can kill your pet bird. Your third question, Terry. Hams are preserved or cured using many methods, but all include this. Is it smoking, drying, aging, or salting?
Salting.
That is correct. Salting is the correct answer.
Wow, Terry's on a roll.
He really is. Your fourth question, Terry. If a super stock is too salty, try this. Simmer sliced potato in it and then remove. Add more liquid. Add lemon juice or add sugar.
I'm going to go with the potato because potato does absorb salt. And, you know, the other one would be add water. So those two things are actually correct. Because if you add water, you actually dilute. But if you add the potato, it will absorb the salt. So I'm going to go with the potato.
You're going to go with A, the potato?
Potato.
That is incorrect.
Okay.
We want to add more liquid. It says, only this will reduce the concentration of salt. Choice A does not really work, despite the thousands of cooks who swear by it.
I just got put in a batch of 1,000 cooks.
Yeah, sorry about that. It's just,
I've never oversalted anything. Just kidding.
That's right.
I've never had to try it.
Perfectly, every single time. All right. Terry, your last question. How long must you cook a sauce on medium heat to eliminate all traces of alcohol? Is it 5 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, or you'll never eliminate all the alcohol?
You will never eliminate all the alcohol entirely.
That is correct.
Thank you. Four out of five.
Very amazing showing today.
Wow.
Is everyone nervous after that one?
Yeah. Way to go,
Shaking. Quivering.
Tom, don't forget you said you're going to beat Bridget.
All right, Bridget. You're a little out of practice, but let's see how it goes. Let's see if you've been studying on your off time here. Your first question. French goat cheese coated with ash is known as, is it A, Hell's Hailstones, B, Devil's Droppings, C, Goat Pellets, or D, Prunes?
I'm going to go with C.
It's actually B.
Oh, you've got to go with your first answer. Okay.
I'm going to probably butcher this pronunciation, but Croton du Diable.
Yep. Croton du Diable?
Yep. Second question. What is the most popular pizza topping in Japan? Is it anchovy? Is it mayo jaga, which is a mayo, potato, and bacon combination? Is it squid or is it pepperoni?
Anchovy.
That is incorrect. It's actually squid.
I was going to say
But
that.
The mayo God, potato bacon option is also very popular. All right. Your third question. Which chicken eggs are more nutritious? Free-range chicken eggs, tanner brown eggs, fertilized eggs regardless of color, or all chicken eggs are about the same? Which one is more nutritious?
They're all about the same.
That's correct. They are all about the same. Very nice. Your fourth question. How old are most supermarket eggs? Are they 1 to 2 days old, 3 to 10 days old, 10 to 14 days old, or 15 to 21 days old?
15 to 21.
It's actually 3 to 10.
That's a lie.
No.
I tend to agree with you, Chef Bridget.
Yeah, like, I know somebody that's stocked at a grocery store.
Was this question made by the Egg Commission?
Yeah, maybe.
All right. The audience is saying we need to give her the point.
Wow.
And you know what? That felt very threatening, so we're going to give you that point.
Whoa,
I am scared of this audience.
You are easily threatened, I guess.
I am very susceptible to peer pressure.
I heard 3 months on eggs at grocery stores.
Really? Your final question. Some apples aren't good for cooking. They become mushy because they don't have enough what? Is it sugar, carbohydrates, cellulose, or pectin?
Pectin. It's cellulose.
I can't give you that.
Okay.
Which one?
Somebody's coming to my bread class.
You still did fairly well there. 2 out of 5, correct?
We'll see, Tom. I don't know.
We'll see, Tom.
We'll see what Tom's questions are.
All right, Tom, your first question. A flinty wine has a taste of minerals, acid, tannin, or sand?
Minerals.
That is correct. Very nice. How can you ripen fruit quickly, Tom? Can you put it in a paper bag with an apple, place in 200-degree oven, leave on a sunny windowsill, or not possible, you can't rush Mother Nature?
I'll go with the apple.
That is correct. Very nice. Monter au beurre, or to mount with butter, means slowly add butter over low heat while stirring to finish a sauce. Mix softened butter with flavorings to create a compound butter. Melt butter to clarify, then add to sauce base. Or mix butter with flour prior to adding to sauce.
Well, both one or the first and last you could do, but I'll just go with the first.
That is correct. Yeah. Very nice. Slowly add
butter.
I've
done both where you've made your roux out of just butter and flour and then stirred it in rather than making it cooked roux.
But
technically it's to mount butter.
Yeah. To mount butter into a liquid.
That's only if you speak French.
You did well, Tom. You still got it correct. Here's your fourth question. Which is the most common form of emulsified sauce? Is it ketchup, mustard, mayo, or hollandaise?
Of an emulsified sauce?
Mm-hmm. Most common.
Most common. Mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise is correct. Wow, you're doing great.
Woo,
so
four out of five.
Let's see if you can go for that perfect
He's blowing
score.
Right I got the tough questions.
Your last question. Bechamel, Mornay, and Soubise are varieties of what? Is it velouté, mushroom, white sauce, or white wine?
A white sauce.
That is correct.
Oh, five out of five.
Five out of five. That means
Mr.
Bridget,
Douglas.
Unfortunately, you lost today, but it was still a very nice showing. Lauren, that means you get two spots in the bread making class.
Yeah,
with Bridget.
Be fun.
Nice. So you're going to have a blast.
If you'd like to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter, Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.